Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from Jersey City in the great state of New Jersey. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm so glad you have chosen to join me either live or in the future. Either way, I don't guess I have any listeners in the past, do I? I've got a great, informative, enlightening, and engaging interview for you this evening. It's all three of those, I promise. We're going to be talking with Carissa Vailis about digital ethics. Carissa has edited one book and written another since being on the show almost 2 years ago, talking about her previous book, Privacy is Power, which is a great book. I'll bring that up also in the interview. But this interview is basically divided into two halves. We're going to hear first some conversation around the Oxford Handbook of Digital Ethics, which you're going to learn all about when I start the interview. And then we're going to talk about her book, The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance, which just came out. And there's some overlap between the two books, which we'll get into. You'll hear about it in the interview. But I just, before we start the interview, I want to say something about this topic of ethics, because I'm afraid that some people may hear the word ethics and think, oh, this is going to be cerebral and boring or something. Wrong. Nothing could be further from the truth. Let me just set this up to say, the intrusion of digital technology into our lives and work and communities and world at large is so pervasive, so massive, so inescapable that everywhere we turn, there is going to be, and there already is, some knotted series of ethical questions, which is to say, what is the right thing to do? What should this piece of technology do? What is the right or the wrong thing, the wrong way for this technology to act or to affect our lives? And conversely, there's a question of how we should act in response to or in relationship to the technology that surrounds us. Okay, so there's both of those. How do we act around the technology, and how should the technology act around us? Those are the two main questions with ethics. And it comes up everywhere. And I'm going to give you an example, because the first example I'm going to bring up from this Oxford Handbook of Digital Ethics, which Carissa edited, is this chapter written by another author, not Carissa, but she was the editor, and it talks about the ethics of human-robot interaction, okay? And we're going to dive right into that at the beginning of the interview. So I just want to prep you why this is so important, give you an example that comes straight from this essay, straight from this chapter, okay? I'm going to read a little selection, okay? A quote, in 2015, CNN ran a story with a headline, "Is it cruel to kick a robot dog?" This was a story about a robot created by the company Boston Dynamics. By the way, that's the robo dog, which I've covered a number of times on the show. You might remember. Continuing, the four-legged robot, nicknamed Spot, looks like a dog. A video released by Boston Dynamics shows Spot walking up some stairs and running on a treadmill. Later in the video, in order to further illustrate how stable Spot is, some Boston Dynamics engineers are shown kicking Spot. Sure enough, Spot does not fall over when kicked. Many viewers of the video, however, lost their composure when they saw Spot being kicked. CNN reported that people made comments such as, "Kicking a dog, even a robot dog, just seems wrong," and "Poor Spot." And so I want to ask you, listeners, what do you think? Is it wrong to kick a robot dog? Now, some people will say, well, I wouldn't kick a robot dog because it probably belongs to the police and I'll get arrested. I get that. I'm asking a slightly different question. Independent of who owns the dog and who's watching and everything, just inherently, you know, like let's just say it's wrong to kick an actual dog. It's one should never, ethically speaking, one should never kick a dog. Okay, granted. Now let's go to a robo dog. Is it unethical to kick a robo dog? You may have an answer right away, but I just want to highlight that as one of the 10,000 ethical questions around digital technology that surround us every day and are going to keep coming. And so the issues that Carissa is dealing with in this handbook, Carissa and her authors, have to do with human-robot interaction, which we just talked about, also fake news, online shaming, trolling, questions of friendship and love in the digital age, the ethics of persuasive technology, you know, manipulative, nudgy interfaces, AI and value alignment, cybersecurity, privacy, surveillance, health, AI, the future of work, the future of democracy, and so on. It just goes on and on and on. And so we're not going to get into all of these in this interview. And as I said, the second half, we're really going to be doing a deep dive on surveillance. But I just want to give you a frame that we're talking about ethics tonight, which is so important. And it's so important in so many different arenas, and it's only increasingly important. So we got to get on this right away to start wrestling with these ethical issues. Again, to understand better what's the right way for us to engage with technology and what's the right way for technology to affect our lives. What are the right and wrong ways? If we have a better ethical sense, then we're going to make better decisions, one would hope. So that's the interview. I'm going to play this now. If you want to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments. And if you're listening in the future, you can go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and go to the July 1st 2024 show and click the playlist link. Let's go ahead and listen now to my interview with Carissa Velez here on Tectonic on WFMU. Carissa Velez, welcome back to Tectonic.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you back on the show. You were first on in November 2022 talking about an earlier book of yours called Privacy is Power, which I still recommend to all Tectonic listeners, and the interview was great. This time I want to talk about a new book, or perhaps a couple of new books. We'll see what we get to. You've been very busy in the last year and a half. But first, let's talk about the Oxford Handbook of Digital Ethics, which you edited. This book includes chapters contributed by a variety of writers and philosophers on 37 topics. This book is over 700 pages long. So a huge and helpful resource covering everything from the ethics of human-robot interaction to the moral risks of online shaming, the ethics of so-called persuasive technology, medical AI, brain uploading, and your own contribution called The Surveillance Delusion, which I liked a lot and we'll get to. I want to start with a chapter called The Ethics of Human-Robot Interaction and Traditional Moral Theories by a researcher named Sven Nyholm. In it, Nyholm is discussing the virtues, the classic virtues praised by philosophers like Plato, Aristotle, and others. And in this chapter, Nyholm writes, "By developing the virtues, we flourish as human beings." But the chapter is about the ethics of human-robot interaction. So the question is, what about, which Nyholm dives into, what about robots and virtues? Are we expecting robots to demonstrate the best possible behavior? Eventually, in the chapter, Nyholm writes what I had been thinking the entire chapter, which is that, I'll quote him, "If anyone should try to cultivate and exemplify virtues, it is the human beings making decisions about how robots will treat people and not the robots themselves." I thought this was a key point in this chapter, that when we talk about ethics and virtues, whether it's about robots or other sorts of digital technology, the question often gets reflected back on human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many questions surrounding this topic about theories and how they interact in AI ethics and with artifacts like robots and algorithms. There are at least three major questions around that. The first one is, what are the kinds of ethical theories and virtues as well that human beings should instantiate and should endorse to make sure that technology is what we want it to be? And I think that is perhaps the most neglected question and the most important one, because as you say, like at the end of the day, human beings are the moral agents. It's not the robots and it's not the algorithm. And therefore, if anyone should be developing the virtues, it's human beings. Two other very important questions that I think have been written on more is, how do we make sure that we code ethics into AI and into robots? And is that even the right way to ask it? Or how do we make sure that at the very least, that the actions of robots and algorithms accord with our moral values and our moral principles? And of course, there are kind of sub-questions around this topic regarding, well, who gets to decide what theory is the right one, or which theory is the right one in which contexts? And can ethics be coded into an AI, or can an AI learn by example? But are human beings good examples of our moral values? And then a third big question, with which Sven also writes about, and you know, he's a wonderful researcher. If you don't know his work, I highly recommend it. He asks whether we need new ethical theories to reflect new realities, and or are the traditional ethical theories enough? And again, a very, very debated topic. Some people think that, well, ethics is ethics, and it's always been ethics. And it doesn't matter if it was 2,000 years ago and you lived in Greece. The kind of major pillars about what is a good life and how to lead one are still the same. And it really, technology doesn't change that much. On the other hand, of course, there are aspects of AI ethics which are very particular. Just like in medical ethics, of course, like the ethical theories still stand, but you have to know about biomedicine to make some adequate judgments. And in this case, for instance, one of the qualities that I think that make AI ethics quite difficult but very interesting is how systemic it is. It's not only about the doctor's office or the hospital. We're using AI everywhere, and we, you know, with robots, potentially the same situation. It's not only in the factory, but as part of the police or armies, or it's even in a domestic context. And that makes AI ethics very, very political in a way that we don't see other aspects or other fields of practical ethics, like medical ethics, being so political.
Yeah, I think I'm more of a traditionalist on this. I think the ethical values from 2,000, 3,000 years ago are going to do us just fine. The problem is that the companies today that are creating the AIs, the algorithms, the robots, they have a particular set of incentives and motivations. And as I've covered on this show over the years, those tend not to be ethical or virtuous. They tend to be growth at any cost. They want to arrogate themselves to the highest levels of power and influence and protect that power for themselves. That's how these companies work. So when you hear about AI, quote unquote, advancements and robots, what these companies often will say is the robot is going to become sentient. The chatbot is going to become sentient. Once we get to artificial general intelligence, it's going to have its own consciousness. And Carissa, I think from a layman's point of view, I think one reason why these companies are making a big deal about sentience is so that they can place the responsibility for unethical behavior on that external agent. They can say, it's not our fault if the algorithm discriminated. It's not our fault if the autonomous weapon system killed innocent civilians. It's not our fault if the robot did something horrible, because they're sentient. So you can go sue the robot for all we care, because we're not liable. That to me is a gross violation of those traditionalist values, if I can call them that, the values from Aristotle. I would rather see the companies forced to embrace more of those old virtues rather than announcing this wonderful new world of robot sentience so that they can let go of their own responsibility for harmful outcomes.
Yeah, I largely agree with you. I think that companies talk a lot about artificial general intelligence, AGI, partly as a way to offload their responsibility, partly as a way to distract from responsibility of harms that are being perpetrated now, so focusing on like existential risk and things like that in the far future makes them feel like their company is safer from public scrutiny. And it also kind of adds to the hype, this idea that AI is so powerful and it's going to be so important. And so it's very refreshing when you see companies that don't do that. And they're a rare minority, but it happens. And I agree with you that I think companies, many companies have lost their way in the sense of this idea that the company is only for profit and only answers to stockholders is very, very recent. If you look at how the company was born, it was born very much in collaboration with the state, which, you know, can create its own problems, but it was born out of the sense that there was a public service that needed to be done. Throughout most of history, if you wanted a corporation, you had to give reasons for why that corporation was going to benefit society. And if you couldn't convince, you know, the king or the queen or your government that your company was going to be good for society, you weren't going to have a company. And so this idea of the company as a good citizen, we've lost. And I think that's quite dangerous. So today is quite a special day for me because it's been announced that I will be part of the board of a new foundation that has been set by Proton. And the idea is that the foundation will oversee the company. And the whole idea is to have a company that, yes, of course, a company has to be profitable, but that has a mission. And the mission is to protect privacy. And the mission of the foundation, in turn, is to make sure that the company never loses that moral compass, that people and rights come first.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. It's really exciting to see a company that's trying to do different and that can show that privacy can be a competitive advantage, that it can be a profitable business, but also an ethical one. And it's very exciting to join the board with, for instance, Tim Berners-Lee, who has been so important in talking about this, the problems of the internet, but also possible solutions and motivating people to do better.
And if listeners don't know, Proton is the company behind services like Proton Mail, which I've recommended a lot over the years. And of course, Tim Berners-Lee is the inventor of the World Wide Web. You're joining a foundation for a recommended company with some well-known web and internet luminaries, of which you are one yourself. So congratulations on that. I have a question about whether that'll work in a lot of companies, having an ethics expert serve on a board or maybe serve as someone with ethical oversight over the company when the company is determined to follow a growth at any cost business model. And this came up a little bit in one of the chapters in the Handbook of Digital Ethics, which you edited. This is a chapter called The Ethical Dimensions of Persuasive Technology, written by someone named James Williams. The persuasive technology that Williams is writing about is the interfaces that give nudges to users to do something that the company may claim is in the user's best interest, but usually is in the company's own interest. It's these slight, little, subtle manipulations of the user taken to an extreme that can make the app an addictive app. A lot of the social media apps make use of persuasive technology tools and methods. Williams writes during this chapter, quote, as these technologies become ever more ubiquitous and indispensable in our lives, attention to their ethical dimensions will become all the more essential for promoting the well-being of users, designers, and society as a whole. Basically, what he's saying is AI and other digital tools are everywhere. They're affecting us all the time now. And if these companies are imbuing their tools with persuasive technology, we really need to get on the ball and understand what are the ethical dimensions or unethical dimensions of these persuasive manipulations. If there's an ethical expert, an AI ethics expert at the company, and this person is telling the CEO or whoever, hey, these nudges, these manipulations, we're turning this into an addictive app. Is that going to be enough to change the course of many technology companies today?
So no, obviously, we need regulation, because if you have a company that has a very toxic culture in which really profit is all that matters, then nothing's going to work, right? We are already seeing changes in companies that pretty much have that attitude thanks to external pressure. And external pressure means pressure from regulators, it means actual regulation, but also pressure from regulators that more regulation is coming and that people can't get away with murder. And also external pressure from the public of saying, like, this is enough. I'm sick and tired of being abused by these companies, and I'm not going to use it, or I'm going to use this other company, and calling them out on it. However, I think companies are potentially dangerous, and there is this impulse. There are two impulses that are quite dangerous. One is to do whatever it takes to create as much profit as possible. And, you know, this is a thing. And the other one is to develop any kind of technology, no matter the consequences, for the sake of technology. This is also a common attitude with regards to AI. It's like, we're going to build this no matter what. Like, if the world falls apart, if democracy gets dismantled, we're still going to get our gadgets. However, companies are also amazing, right? I mean, most of the things we love around us were created by a company. And there are many people who are very idealistic, and not even very idealistic, who genuinely want to make the world a better place, and that they build companies to do so. You know, the people who are in publishing are very often people who really, really care about the industry, and they don't only care about profit. Of course, there are people who care about profits, and there are problems everywhere. But it's not, we shouldn't be complete cynics. We should be very careful, and we should regulate properly. But at the same time, we shouldn't be cynics. And I have met people in industry who want to make things right, who want to make products that help society and that don't harm society. So when you have an expert on a board, it's a mixture of things. It's first that they can issue a warning. And once the warning is issued, that puts pressure on the company, because it's not like, oh, you know, I didn't see it coming. It's like, no, you got told that this was dangerous and you still went ahead. And that's going to be very risky for the company, because, you know, in a year's time, when a regulator looks at that paperwork and there's a paper trail that somebody flagged something, that matters. But it's also a case of persuasion. It's also a case, like, people are human beings. And when you look at, in the eyes of somebody, and you tell them, like, do you want to build a product that's going to harm your own kids and the kids of your kids? Like, is this where you want to go? I think a lot of people are willing to backtrack. And it's also about building trust. So a good company is one that employees and other partners, other business partners, but also the public can trust. And you don't want to be the CEO of a company whose employees, for instance, are ashamed of saying that they work for your company and they don't trust you. And whose customers say, like, yeah, I'm here because I'm trapped, but, like, the moment I get an alternative, they'll kind of fly away, because that makes you very brutal. So I think there are good reasons to be ethical above and beyond just, I mean, you should be ethical because you should want to do the right thing. But even if you are just kind of more selfish, but, like, smart selfish, there are good business reasons to be ethical.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're just about halfway through my interview with Carissa Vailis, who has edited the Oxford Handbook of Digital Ethics. So we're talking about digital ethics from a number of different angles, as you can hear. Human-robot interaction and manipulative, persuasive interfaces, the viability of AI ethics boards or experts advising senior leadership who may be growth at any cost type people, and so on. And in the second half of the interview, we're going to get to Carissa's own work on surveillance. She wrote one of the chapters, which you'll hear about. She has this concept called the surveillance delusion, which I liked a lot. If you'd like to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments. Let's go ahead and listen to the rest of the interview here on Tectonic on WFMU. I want to talk about your chapter in the Handbook of Digital Ethics, Carissa. This is a chapter called the surveillance delusion. You've written a lot about surveillance. In fact, you also have a new book out. I know this is strange to be talking about the Handbook of Digital Ethics and to mention yet another book, but it's true. In January, you came out with a book called The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance, also published by Oxford University Press. That book and this handbook chapter, The Surveillance Delusion, together, I just found them delicious, both of them. Getting your insights about the questions around surveillance, some of the trade-offs, and ultimately what the harms are as we build a mass surveillance society. I want to start with a definition. You write that the surveillance delusion is the assumption that surveillance has no significant moral costs. And I can assure listeners that there are people out there who embrace this delusion, who say, well, surveillance is not that big a deal because XYZ, they have all sorts of rationalizations. So let's start there, Carissa. What should we know about the surveillance delusion, this assumption that there are no harms with surveillance?
Yeah, so that's the first time I published about this term. And then I revisited in The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance. And I think I polished it a bit more and kind of fleshed out a bit more this concept. And the idea is, whenever there is a company or a government deciding whether to surveil or not, usually they're doing a kind of cost-benefit analysis. And the benefits of surveillance tend to be very obvious and very immediate. So for instance, if you want to serve people personalized ads, it's very easy to calculate how much money you're going to win and how many people are going to look at it. And it's very easy to monetize, and it happens immediately, right? So you kind of show the ad and people start clicking on it, or you start collecting personalized data and then you sell it next day to a company. And when people look at the disadvantages of surveillance, it's very often the case that they see little or none. And that's because surveillance is a kind of lamp, and it sheds light on many things, but not on itself. It obscures itself. It's the very nature of surveillance. One example I give in the book is how, you know, during the COVID pandemic, but this has gone on after the pandemic, we started seeing a lot of spyware being used in the context of work. So people working from home were asked to install very invasive programs that took a look at exactly how fast they were working. And in some cases, they even had the camera on and were checking like whether they were taking too many bathroom breaks or too long bathroom breaks. The benefits of that, or the apparent benefits of that, were very easy to monetize. You could see like, oh, this worker is writing 200 words per hour or whatever it was. And then you can make a calculation whether that was a good worker or not. But the costs were completely invisible. So that person was stressed out of their minds and producing much worse work. But the surveillance company wasn't going to measure that, first, because they don't have an interest in measuring that. But secondly, it's much more complicated to measure that. How do you measure whether somebody is really so stressed out that their quality of work is going downhill, or they're kind of suffering from more health problems? It's not only harder to quantify, it's also further down the line. So it typically has long-term effects and not short-term effects. And another great example is journalism. So if you completely destroy privacy in a country, it becomes very hard for investigative journalism to thrive, because journalists cannot keep themselves safe or their sources safe. So are you going to go to a journalist with a story, say, about government wrongdoing if you are being surveilled all the time? Of course not. You're not going to do that. So eventually, investigative journalism dies, and that affects democracy. But it's not something you can measure. Like, what number do you put on that in a cost-benefit analysis? You can say like, well, journalism is a business. And sure, it has some economic benefits to society, but that's not its main benefit. Its main benefit is in democracy, and you can't put a number on that. And secondly, you can't measure it. And thirdly, it's probably going to happen not immediately, but throughout months and years, and suddenly you don't have a democracy anymore. So that's the idea of the surveillance delusion. This fact about surveillance having very obvious benefits, very short-term and very quantifiable, makes it seem like it doesn't have any kind of moral cost because it's not as easily quantifiable and it's in the long term.
Yeah, in this chapter, you mentioned the Pegasus Project, which involved the use of intrusive surveillance, really spyware, on the smartphones of journalists, human rights activists, and even heads of state that were listening in and tracking these individuals all over the world. I did a show with Sandrine Rigaud, who's the co-author of the book Pegasus, and helped break the story about the Pegasus Project. The harms on democracy are exactly what you say. When you can't have journalists keeping an eye on what government and corporate actors are doing, things tend to break down. There was another aspect of the surveillance delusion that you bring up that I think is worth talking about, which is the myth that privacy can actually coexist in a mass surveillance society. Here's what you write. Those who think that data collection is not a privacy worry tend to think of privacy or the right to privacy as a matter of access. As long as the data does not get accessed, there is no privacy invasion. I thought this was so well stated because this is what we heard years ago from the National Security Agency, the NSA, here in the U.S. They said in a congressional hearing, sure, we're tracking Americans' phone calls and texts and everything, but don't worry, we don't access the communications of innocent Americans. So you're not actually being spied on. We're just storing it. We're not accessing it. And that just seemed to me so disingenuous.
Yeah, there's so much there. I mean, firstly, if you care about ethics, then presumably you also care about any agency spying on people, even if they're not your, you know, citizens of your country. You know, other citizens matter too, and other countries matter too. And you don't want to be in a world in which democracy is eroded around the world, because your democracy will be much more at risk if that's the case. So it's very important that democratic countries ally in having good standards of privacy. But yeah, that argument, we saw it in the UK as well. And the idea is that, we're just kind of collecting this information, but we're not accessing it. So it's not actually a privacy problem. It doesn't count. One of the arguments and the implications is that it doesn't count as mass surveillance. It would be mass surveillance if we were all accessed, but if it's only all collected but not accessed, then it's not mass surveillance. And of course, this ignores how power relations change the moment there is that kind of data collection. So one of the analogies I make with in the book, The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance, is with the right to security. So when we think about the right to security or to safety, we don't only mean that we don't get harmed or killed today, but that nobody has a right to risk or impose significant risk on us. So if somebody points a gun to your head, even if they don't shoot, they are changing that power relationship significantly. Because somebody might point a gun to your head and say, like, just carry on your day. Everything's going to be fine. No matter what you do, I'm not going to shoot you. Right. But, like, you know, there's a gun pointing to your head. So do you think that's going to change the way you behave? Absolutely. Does it change the way you behave when you know that the government has all of your communications? Absolutely. So that kind of asymmetry of power is lost on this idea. So what I argue in The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance is really the right to privacy is a right, in very philosophical jargon, to a robust good. And that means that I want privacy. To have my right to privacy respected doesn't not only means that you respect my privacy here and now, but that you respect it in relevant counterfactual situations. So it doesn't matter if I change my political party or my religion, or if suddenly it becomes very profitable for you to access my data. So if, you know, you and I meet for a coffee and I take my diary and I forget it, and instead of giving it back to me, you keep it just in case you might use it someday. It matters that you don't access it, but it also matters that you kept it. That is a morally significant act, and you are violating my right to privacy, even if technically I'm not losing any privacy until you access that.
Yeah, as you write in The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance, quote, the surveillance system we have in place facilitates structural domination. We live subject to the power of knowers, corporations like Google and Meta and prying governments. It involves living at the mercy of others. A dominated person is not the master of her own life. So it's not simply that we're being spied on and it's just this ambient cloud of a bad vibe or something. You're using the word domination, structural domination.
This idea comes from the philosopher Philip Pettit. And Philip Pettit has this notion that we tend to think about a loss of freedom as somebody intervening in our actions. And that, of course, is a loss of freedom. But he thinks that freedom is a more robust kind of good. You can be unfree and still have no one interfere with you. If they have the power to interfere with you with impunity at any moment, then you're as much as a slave as if they were interfering with you. So a slave who has a very good master who says like, oh, you can just go about your daily life and I won't mess with it, is still a slave because a master could interfere at any point with absolute impunity. And that changes how we see ourselves. It changes how we act. It changes the very foundation of democracy. And he has the test, which he calls the eyeball test. And the idea is when somebody isn't dominated, they are able to look into the eyes of someone without fear and without deference. Could you look into the eyes of someone, let's say that you have a small business and you really depend on social media to advertise your business and to kind of interact with your customers, or let's say that you're a journalist and actually most people access your news stories through social media, or let's say that you're a writer and that you have a big following on social media, and if you got banned from social media, you wouldn't sell your books. So can any of these people truly look into the eyes of somebody like, I don't know, you name it, but maybe Elon Musk, without any fear and without deference?
Speaking of people like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and others, you mention in The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance another kind of rationalization, a perverse rationalization that very wealthy people like these tech billionaires can make, which is surveillance isn't an issue because it doesn't affect me. You write that one should not need to be wealthy to have one's right to privacy respected. Privacy should not be treated as a luxury item. Very few people have enough money to do what Mark Zuckerberg did to protect his privacy. He bought the four houses surrounding his home for about $30 million. Zuckerberg's ability to buy privacy for himself, while duplicitously claiming that privacy is not a social norm anymore, and having Facebook rob the personal data of billions of netizens, highlights the power inequality that separates Silicon Valley and the like from the rest of mortals. So well put. It seems like not just the very apex billionaires like Zuckerberg and Musk, but other very wealthy people seem to have the means to protect themselves from the surveillance that affects everyone else. And as you also write, people without very many means or resources tend to be subject to much greater and much more intrusive daily surveillance.
Yeah, that's right. And in Privacy is Power, I argue that privacy is as collective as it is personal. So to a certain extent, you're right, like the rich can protect themselves much more. And, you know, they're not going to need a loan. They're not going to be asking for a job. And they can buy four houses around them and have a bunker. So to a certain extent, that's true. And it's wrong because privacy is a right. It's not a commodity. However, privacy is also, as I argue in Privacy is Power, as collective as it is personal. So the day that democracy falls, we all fall with it, because you might be as millionaire as you want. But if there's a strong man who doesn't like you, you're in trouble. And even if that doesn't happen to you, you don't want to live in a country in which there is a failing democracy, where there's no rule of law, or where there might be violence or instability. Everybody benefits from having a stable, fair society. But it's true that too often the people who are undermining privacy are very protective of their own privacy.
There's one other aspect of surveillance that I came across in The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance that I hadn't seen worded quite in this way before, and I think it's really important. You mentioned that you coined the term the iron law of digitization, which is as follows: to digitize is to surveil. And what you're saying here is that digitization inherently leads to surveillance. I mean, for so long I've been saying, look at this platform, look at this piece of software, look at this tool out here, look how they're surveilling us. But you take this further, Carissa. You're saying digitization means surveillance.
I'm actually unsure about how necessary or contingent this relationship is. At the moment, it's necessary, but it might be that we can redesign the digital so that it's not this way. But I am still undecided. And I think it partly depends on the creativity of engineers to come. But very often, we get told two things. The first one is that technology is neutral and that it just depends on how we use it, if we make it good or bad. And the second is that everything digital is good. And in the worst case, it's even better than the analog, right? The digital is the kind of shiny new toy. This is so misleading on so many levels. So first, we forget that everything digital depends on the analog. If you destroy the analog world, if you destroy the natural world, if you destroy the coffee shops, if you destroy communities, then there's no digital. There's no digital that will be... The digital can never replace the analog. But also, it fails to note that whenever we translate the analog into digital, whenever we take a thing in the world and translate it into ones and zeros, we are contributing to the architecture of surveillance, because suddenly you have something that wasn't data turned into data, and you have something that wasn't trackable that is suddenly trackable and taggable and searchable. And what is it to track if it's not to surveil? So tech companies want to grow. And how do you grow in the 21st century when you already have billions of users? One possibility is to try to recruit younger and younger users, which has landed a company like Meta in very hot water and has harmed a lot of very young people, children. We're harming children. So just a few days ago, there was a news about how TikTok is using the data from teenagers who are expressing sadness to feed them self-harm videos. This is still happening. But once you run out of users, how do you grow? You colonize the analog. You turn everything you possibly can into the digital. But in so doing, you're also turning everything into something that is surveilled. And if we don't want surveillance to be ubiquitous, then we need spaces that are not digitized. And that's probably very healthy for mental well-being, right? Most of the more valuable interactions we have with our family, with our friends, when you read a book, when you go for a walk in nature, are analog. However, we could redesign the digital. So for instance, at the moment, when you create a file, it's permanent. But there's no reason why it should be like that. That's a decision that's made by design. We could design most files to expire, say, in different, maybe in a year. It depends on the kind of file. We could redesign the digital in a different way. However, it might be the case that it's still turning something into data that wasn't. And by that, you are still risking privacy.
I feel like we can continue this conversation well past our appointed time here, Carissa, because this topic is so rich and so important and so multifaceted. But we'll call it there. I want to recommend both of your newest books to Tectonic listeners. They're both published by Oxford University Press. They are The Oxford Handbook of Digital Ethics, which you edited, and most recently, The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance. Carissa Vailes, thank you so much again for being on Tectonic, and I hope you'll be back again sometime.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It was a pleasure.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining 12 minutes of the show, and then Dave Mandel comes into Studio A. Are you ready for Dave Mandel? Is it something you can handle? He's got his show, It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show, which you should listen to. And then after that, continue listening to Bad Animals with Amanda and Jim the Poet. And then brother Daniel Blumen with his eponymous show, going from 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time. Just stay tuned, is my recommendation. I want to say thanks to Carissa Vales for coming back on the show. First time she was on the show was November 2022, so almost, well, not quite 2 years ago. In 2022, she was talking about her previous book, Privacy is Power. There's a link to that interview on the playlist. I'd recommend it. This time, as you heard, she was talking about two books. The first, the book that she edited, The Oxford Handbook of Digital Ethics, and most recently, her book that she authored, The Ethics of Privacy and Surveillance, both published by Oxford University Press. And there are links to both of those books on the playlist. Go to the OUP website. I would recommend taking a look if you are interested in digital ethics, which I hope you, if you were unsure at the beginning of the interview, I hope you see the scope and the depth and the, I'll just say, the urgency of this topic in so many different aspects of life. We spent a good deal of time talking about the ethics of surveillance, but of course, digital ethics go well beyond that, going all the way back to my first example of, do you kick a robot dog? And there were a couple of different takes on the comment board, which you can read if you go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments, or again, in the future, find the playlist for July 1st, 2024 at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And good comments throughout the interview. Thanks to the listeners for participating. It's hard to fit digital ethics into one single show because there are so many different aspects and categories that it connects with. But one thing that I want to point out is that this show you can think of a little bit as a continuation of last week's show. If you didn't hear, last week I interviewed Byron Tao, who has a book out called Means of Control, which talks about the partnership between government agencies and private corporations to work together to surveil American citizens. And as I think I said last week, this is not a problem that is unique to the U.S. If you live outside the country, you probably have the same issue wherever you live. And if you don't live in China, in fact, you are probably being surveilled by American companies wherever you are. But there was a scene in my interview with Byron Tao last week that I brought up again this week with Carissa Vales. If you've listened to both shows, you know what I'm about to say. But back in 2013, there was this Senate committee hearing that featured the director of national intelligence, this guy James Clapper. And Oregon Senator Ron Wyden asked James Clapper, this isn't the exact wording, but essentially, is the government or is the NSA surveilling or spying on American citizens? And Clapper said, no, which left Wyden very surprised because he knew the answer was yes. And as Byron Tao wrote, James Clapper also knew the answer was yes. Of course, the government was spying and continues to spy today in 2024 on American citizens. And if you think about this from the context of tonight's interview about digital ethics, I hope you can listen to what Carissa Bailey said and you can evaluate this from an ethical standpoint, and you can say what the government is doing, using its asymmetry of power to surveil American citizens without their consent and largely, I would say, without their knowledge, is wrong. It is wrong. When we talk about ethics, yes, we talk about right and wrong. And it is wrong. As I thought the example Carissa gave was so good. If you write a diary, you remember diaries? Kids, people used to use pen and paper to write down their thoughts at the end of each day in a little book. Private thoughts that you don't want other people to read. If someone picked up your diary and held on to it, it would worry you that your private thoughts, your private reflections, your private, I'm underlining the word private, your private words have been collected by somebody, and who knows what they're going to do with them. That's wrong for someone to take your diary. Can we say that? Well, that's essentially what the U.S. government has done, as along with its corporate partners, Facebook, Google, Amazon, and so on, the big tech partners, the data brokers, they have stolen your private data. And what the government says, I mean, the for-profit companies, you can't really believe anything that they say, and sometimes they will go ahead and admit that, yes, they are surveilling people for profit. Once in a while, they admit it. But the government says, we are not actually spying on you because we haven't actually accessed the data of most of the people whose information we've taken. And so that's the common element to last week's show and this week's show. The same question came up twice in a row where we're engaging this question. If someone steals your diary, if someone steals your private information, does that act by itself count as spying? Does it count as surveillance? And it's important because if the answer is yes, and I believe it is yes, then we should say something about that because what the government is doing is wrong. It is wrong. And in legal terms, we could say it's unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment protection and so on. Byron Tao and I talked about that last week. But I'm hoping that this show gives you a sense of the importance of digital ethics in so many of our interactions with technology. And so often, unfortunately, the conclusion that I have using an ethical filter onto my interactions day to day with technology is this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. Oh, that one's wrong too. And that one's really wrong. And this is offensively wrong. And that is completely disgustingly wrong, Mark Zuckerberg, and so on. There are very few things that I go and I say, you know what, that's ethical. Very few things from powerful technology companies or government agencies do I find to be really well thought out and ethical. So we need a sea change. We need a giant change. And the first step for that is for us to gain some better awareness. And so I'm glad that you've tuned in and I hope you learned something. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel. And hey, why don't we listen to a song about Google, huh? Here we go. Stop, where do you dare me to draw the line?
my data, now you want my soul. Don't even think about it, say no, Google. Yeah, I'll do anything that you want me to do. Yeah, I do almost anything that you want me to do. Yeah, but I won't Google that, no. See you're spying, that's not nice. I can see you're just repeating the same old lies. Use my data, now you want my soul. Ooh, forget about it, now say no, Google. Yeah, I'll do anything that you want me to do.
And good evening, everybody. How are you? I'm fine. My name is Dave. I'm the host of this program, which is called It's Complicated. The show comes to you every Monday evening between the hours of 7 and 8 p.m. 1 hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. Lovely to be here again playing music for you tonight. Thanks for joining me. We're going to start tonight's show with some music from España, from Spain. We're going to hear a group called Amoeba Split, and this will be a recent thing, 2023 release, oh, so recent. And they are, Amoeba Split is from Spain, as I mentioned, and there's sort of a combination of Canterbury-ish, the Canterbury School of Prague, with some actually kind of traditionally Spanish elements, trumpets and things like that. Speaking of trumpets, we're going to start, this track begins appropriately enough to start the show with a little fanfare. So this is Amoeba Split. Haha, just kidding, this is it. And after a couple seconds of dead air, we're back. Amoeba Split playing for you there. They are again from Spain. And we heard a track from a 2023 release called Quiet Euphoria, a track called The Inner Driving Force from the group Amoeba Salt. We're going to move on to, I was going to say bigger and better things. No, it's all big. It's all good.